Welcome to the Early Bird Book Club podcast. This is Deanna Larson with Nashville Public Library. Today we're speaking with Christopher Kokinos, the author of Hope is the Thing with Feathers, Personal Chronicle of Vanished Birds. Chris is an award-winning poet and writer and a professor of English at Utah State University. He received the Whiting Writers Award, the Glasgow Prize for an Emerging Writer in Nonfiction, and the Sigurd Olsen Nature Writing Award. The book weaves together natural history, biology, sociology, and personal narrative to tell the story about the lives, habitats, and deaths of six extinct bird species. I start out by asking Chris about the original pub date of the book.
When was this book published? Was it 2000?
It was published in 2000, in March of 2000, to coincide with the centennial of the shooting of the last wild passenger pigeon. So there was a real, you know, date tie-in that as I was working on the book, I realized, oh, wait a second, there's this anniversary, and the publisher was excited by that. And I think that time peg really actually helped the book a lot because the story of that passenger pigeon was, you know, so compelling.
Mm-hmm. Rereading some sections, especially on the great auk, and it just struck me how sad so many of these stories are. And a lot of our Early Bird Book Club readers have asked you things about the future and what you hope for. But before we get to that, I wanted to talk to you. Beyond the Carolina parakeet, what was it that made you commit to a book of this size with this amount of research?
Well, it's a good question because when I started the book, I had no idea what I was getting into. So I really backed into it. I began with, you know, that experience at the lake, which I write about at the beginning of the book, where I see, you know, this exotic bird from the tropics, and then I learn about Carolina parakeets, which were indigenous to the eastern third of the United States, and it just snowballed. And over the first, gosh, I'd say 3 or 4 years, maybe 3 years, I was gathering information, thinking about how I would write poems, actually. Mm-hmm. And I'm not as skilled a poet as I am, I think, as a nonfiction writer, and I realized, you know, I can't do this in poetry. There's too much factual material that I want to do and places I need to go, and it just really snowballed. So the commitment was more of a sense of learning these facts, learning these stories, and wanting to do honor to them. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, I found myself having to do all this research and all this travel that I really wasn't, you know, prepared to do at the start, but then kind of grew into the project.
I know you are a poet and you're a professor of English. Was this your first book of nonfiction?
It was, absolutely. Yep. I had written some essays. Mm-hmm. At that point, I was exploring nonfiction as a genre. When you know, the story grabbed hold of me, really, mm-hmm. rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you finished this book, did you feel done with the topic?
I was ready to move on, yeah. It coincided with working very hard in Kansas. I was living in Kansas at the time with my then wife and teaching at Kansas State, and I was very involved in state environmental, you know, conservation issues and politics. Uh-huh. And I was tired. I mean, you know, the book was draining, and trying to get everything done in order to meet the deadline to have the book out for the centennial of the shooting of this bird. And it was long, long, long days. And in a way, I had trained as a journalist as an undergraduate, and that training came back and helped me.
It was like,
okay, you're on deadline. You have to work really hard now. So that coincided with kind of burning out, you know, with my activist work in Kansas. And it's only been in the past 2 or 3 years here now in Utah, where I live, that energy to go back to conservation stuff, you know, has really come back.
I noticed that you're an adjunct associate professor of environment and society as well as a professor of English.
Right.
What came first, your love of environment and then you sought out work in that field, or was it the other way around?
It was really the other way around. I came to a love of, you know, the non-human world and natural history and science kind of late in life. Well, let me amend that. I mean, I was always interested in aspects of science, but I never was good enough in school to do anything about that. You know, so I wanted to be an astronaut, but that didn't work out too well since I was kicked out of advanced algebra. So the interest in birds and habitats and the natural world came really late. It was in college, and I was introduced to, just getting off my butt and stop watching TV and going out on hikes with the woman I would then marry, and her job took us to Kansas, and we continued that journey there. And also a very good friend of mine, who I was working with at the time, at Indiana University in administrative library positions, and he had grown up in the country and knew his birds, and so things kind of coalesced. And when they did, it felt like an epiphany. You know, it felt like, wow, you know, there's this whole other story out there that I've not paid attention to.
I'm interested in the impetus. You know, sometimes the subject directs which form we should put it in, and it seems really clear. But it's interesting that you thought first that these subjects would make good poems, and I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that process of why you thought that compressed and very concentrated art form would be suitable, and then did you feel that you lost or gained anything by expanding out?
Well, that's a good question. I think I was reading some big sprawling poets at the time. Had love for Whitman, and Robinson Jeffers, who is a much maligned poet, and in fact, I think his longer poems really aren't very, very good in retrospect. So I was sort of looking at those as models of, maybe I could, write about the histories of these birds and these people who, were trying to save them and trying to kill them. Sometimes the same people were doing that at the same time, and it just, I just didn't have the technical sort of capacity, I think, to handle that in poetry in a way that, that someone like, W.S. Merwin or someone like that could have, I think, written beautiful, long poems about these birds. I also, at the time, was thinking, I need to try another genre. I need to try nonfiction. No one was really doing that at Kansas State. I'd had some success writing essays, and it seemed to me that genre, and it's still, it feels this way to me today, that combination of a journalist's sort of diligence and adherence to fact, a scholar's sense of research and also, being thorough, but also that poet's sense of craft and imagery and lyricism, all of those things can come together in nonfiction. And it just coalesced in a way that made sense.
Yeah, the book is very poetic, yet full of really interesting and pertinent facts. And I'm wondering if, as an environmental activist, if you feel that one form or another, persuasive essay or poem or nonfiction book or newspaper article, it works better or is more effective at mobilizing people to care about these subjects?
Oh, that's a good question. And I think in just the 9 years that the book has been, been out and now has been reprinted, the media landscape has changed so dramatically. It's very hard, I think, for things to reach people, and yet they are reaching people. It's this paradox of over information in a way, and so I come back to just the necessity of telling a story, and the form in which you tell that story could be a blog, it could be a book, it could be an essay, it could be a conversation with someone on the other side of an issue in your hometown that you might not otherwise talk to. So I think storytelling and conversation is really important, and the form in which that takes place now, I think, is maybe less important. Mm-hmm. But over the years, I've had people write to me, and this was strange, because the book tells sad stories, although I think there is hope in the book, and there is heroism in the book on the part of these characters, these real people who, James Tanner and others, these ornithologists who worked on behalf of habitats and birds. Mm-hmm. And those stories resonated with people, and I got letters, from strangers saying, this book helped me renew my sense of commitment to activism and, caring about a particular place. And that was, and still today is very strange and wonderful for me to think about.
Well, I think you do say in the afterword, it's the power of words to affect some great change or to actually create emotion in people. which is the real use to me of books like this.
Well, I hope so, and I hope that remains the case. And my privilege in doing the book was that I was lucky enough to have found a lot of these stories and recovered some things that hadn't been really put together or synthesized in a way. And if in some way those stories are helping people in their own neighborhoods, in their own communities, inner city, suburban, rural, wherever you may be, to look at something in that place differently and know it better and fall in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the first two crucial steps to actually making a difference in the world, that you know something and that you love it. And that I think is true of, social justice issues caring about a bug that no one else may know anything about. And if you can convey that passion and that care to other people, then, you're on the way.
And I don't know, sometimes it's very mysterious why we have a connection to a subject or a person or living beings, but I am very interested, being an avid backyard birder myself, which
yeah.
I'm very interested in, why do birds, now I know everybody has their thing, some people love dogs like I do as well.
Or meteorites,
you're right, which we can't wait to talk about that, or horses or whatever, but...
Right.
What do you think the eternal appeal is of birds?
Well, I think this insight is not original with me, but, they are, I think Pete Dunn has talked about this, a writer and birder, and others, that here are these consummate wild creatures, and they come close to us, every day. We see them every day, in every sort of place, in all kinds of weather, and maybe sometimes we don't really want to see that giant flock of starlings, over our house in winter, or, enough with the Canada geese pooping on the golf course, but the birds are with us all the time, and I think that is the appeal. And then once you begin, and I'm not really particularly a very good birder. I mean, I joke that the birds I know best are dead, so I can't, I don't really need a field guide for those. But when I'm out in the field with people who are more expert than I am, which is most people, then I'm finding the same holds true for them, that their initial connection was just this kind of magical moment of seeing a beautiful bird or some interesting thing happening, seeing a hawk maybe take a snake from, a field of alfalfa somewhere. You see these amazing things, and there too is that hook of beauty and love and knowledge, and seeing a bird singing or catching prey or, building a nest. Those are also stories. I think we want to connect to those, and that's why they have so much power for us, I think. A lot of them are very pretty.
That usually, I think it starts out, especially for backyard birders, it starts out with them wanting to attract the pretty, colorful songbirds.
Sure.
And then it sort of naturally leads to, well, the starlings deserve to eat, and so do those big ravens and the crows,
Yeah.
And then your heart kind of goes out to, for me, it was all of a sudden realizing that they're sort of like the last vestiges of just wild animals. Nobody pays attention to them, but they breed and multiply, and they forage and feed themselves, all without any intervention usually by human beings.
Well, that's right. And so there are these amazing lives that are going on around us in the skies. And of course, that I think is also part of the appeal, that, ancient mythic impulse to fly. And I don't know anyone who hasn't had a dream, at least when they were a kid, of, having, this power to fly through the air. And so that's still pretty spectacular, even though, of course, we have the scientific explanations. And I don't think that drains any mystery from it. But there they are in the air, beautifully colored often, doing interesting things. I think just being able to, again, at sort of even a basic level, like know this bird versus that one or that song versus this one, that begins to open up some amazing things. So I have to tell you this story. When we first moved, when Kathy and I first moved to Utah, I kept hearing this sort of high-pitched call that I probably heard elsewhere, but I'm not very good with the songs, and it sounded like a wren whose song was being truncated, like a house wren. And I soon learned, well, that's a yellow warbler. Beautiful bird, and they're very common here, common nesting bird. That led me to learn that they recognize cowbirds' eggs, and cowbirds are brood parasites, those birds that lay their eggs in other birds' nests and then move on. You know, they're the lazy parents because they just drop their eggs there and say, you know, thanks, daycare, you know, I'm done. So, I mean, daycare is good. You know what I'm saying? They're like, they take advantage of other species, and when those eggs hatch, their chicks are much bigger, and they outcompete the native birds. But yellow warblers, for some reason, are able to recognize cowbird eggs. And that little fact alone gave me this sense of, wow, you know, that's a really cool bird. And so whenever I hear that song, I have this little sense of, you know, all right, you're a survivor. and you're a beautiful bird. And oh, by the way, you know, you're also the descendant of dinosaurs. So I think there are a lot of reasons why we connect with these creatures, and birding has become a huge industry.
It has, and I guess it's luckily it starts with your local community and your own backyard, which I think is beautiful, and it can expand out as large as you want that hobby to expand out, and it can become as complicated or as simple as you want it to be.
Yeah, indeed. You know, and you know, as you know, I mean, there are a lot of people who take this obsession, you know, to a pretty extreme level and do a lot of traveling around the world. And I can't, gosh, I think it's Dan Knopfel is his name, who has a book that's out in the past couple of years, To See Every Bird on Earth. I respect that obsession, although I won't participate in it. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because sometimes it's like, I know there's no substitution for seeing something live with your own eyes, but certainly sometimes I can be happy just knowing that such a gorgeous bird exists in Bermuda, for instance, or this gorgeous bird is in South America without maybe necessarily needing to hunt it down with binoculars.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the downsides of the globalization of nature, if I can use that phrase, is that sense that one has to, and maybe this has been fueled by the Discovery Channel and National Geographic and so forth, all valuable venues, but that sense that the exotic, the really spectacular, the beautiful is to be found in Costa Rica or Sub-Saharan Africa or, you know, Central Asia. And it's not in, you know, East St. Louis. It's not in, you know, the Cross Timbers. It's not in Cache Valley here in northern Utah, but it is. And if there's one thing that I want people to take from Hope is the Thing with Feathers, is that sense of place, and that you are in a particular place, and that place is storied with human stories and non-human stories, and that's where a defense of non-human nature and the best of human nature begins. It doesn't begin 2,000 miles away. It begins where you live.
That is a fabulous thought. And on that note, I want to start asking some of the questions that our Early Bird Book Club members had asked.
Sure.
That they specifically wanted you to answer.
Okay.
The first one is, one of the readers was talking about, you know, your discussion of the ivory-billed woodpecker.
Yeah.
And the reader says, I really want the ivory-billed to have survived. What do you think, how do you think emotion versus science works in the lives of ornithologists?
Well, I think science is predominant, and the arguments over the ivory bill, and I've, you know, as the afterword to the book, you know, I think makes clear I'm ambivalent. I want very much for that bird to be around as well, but I'm also, you know, a little skeptical. But Tim Gallagher and the other people at Cornell are adamant that they have good evidence. And so, you know, some of the people who have been very critical of that have, you know, thrown out some pretty harsh accusations, faith-based ornithology being one of them. Those are fighting words in any scientific discipline. So I'm content, you know, to stand on the sidelines and see how all that plays out. Emotion is certainly a part of scientific culture. I mean, there are people too. You know, egos get involved, a sense of career gets involved, and so forth. But I think foundationally, it is the case that ornithologists, just as, you know, people who study meteorites or people who study cancer or what have you, most of them are working ethically, professionally, right, out of respect of the scientific method and peer-reviewed science. So I don't think that emotion has played a role in distorting evidence. I think there's simply a question of, is this evidence good enough to convince other people? And so far, that has not been the case.
Okay. Another question was about the greater prairie chicken at Martha's Vineyard. The reader said, I didn't get a sense of his personal feelings about a reintroduction. Could he speak to that?
Well, I didn't want to go there in my afterword because I feel pretty removed from that that particular part of my journey now several years ago. And I would defer to Tom Chase, who directs the Nature Conservancy office there at Martha's Vineyard, and other conservationists in that part of the world in Massachusetts. And I think the goals there are more modest and more achievable, you know, to introduce a fire ecology on the island, and to undevelop the island in certain ways, you know, as a house goes on up for sale, to be able to acquire that property and return it to a natural state. Those are crucial things. And to me, the introduction or reintroduction of a prairie chicken subspecies on the island now feels like less of the issue. If it were to happen in a way that, again, that there was a consensus scientifically and in terms of the community, that would be wonderful. I mean, there's no doubt that would be really cool to go back to Martha's Vineyard, go to the land that used to be James Green's farm where the last heath hen was heard, and to hear prairie chickens booming again. But the scientific consensus is not there, and I don't know that it ever will be.
Another reader wondered, what have you noticed, if any, in the average American's appreciation of birds and the desire to conserve them? And do you think this desire has been enhanced by the ongoing green movement?
Well, I think definitely it has been enhanced. I don't have the numbers here in front of me, but I think it would be fairly easy to look at the amount of money that was spent on bird watching, on birding as a recreational sport, as a hobby, say 50 years ago versus what it is now. I mean, it's huge. And there's more money is spent by people who do birding than by hunters and anglers, although they're a crucial part of the conservation equation as well. And there's this continuing sort of, I would say tension between the hunting and fishing community, which has to purchase licenses, right? And those licenses go to protect species and habitats, and birders who aren't licensed, you know, it's a different sort of activity. So that's another issue to sort of be worked out. As far as the average American's appreciation of birds and birding, I'm not sure I have a good handle on that. I mean, I teach English classes. My students are sometimes surprised when we go outside and I've clipped up pictures of birds for them to look at through binoculars, because we're going to talk about nature writing. We're going to read some, you know, of the classic nature literature of the 20th century. I'm going to have them write some of that themselves. And most of the time, those students have not really paid attention to the birds of their own surrounding. And so I feel like just getting them exposed to that is worth the effort. I think that the average American is paying more attention to environmental issues in general, but there too it might just be in that sort of news cycle sort of way, and public opinion polls show that, you know, people are concerned about climate change and so forth. But it really does come back to that, what we were talking about earlier, which is a particular person in a particular place seeing something real, this bird, that butterfly, this flower, and then that becomes a doorway into a larger sense of community.
Maybe a larger sense of ownership about what makes up your community, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that Aldo Leopold was writing about that in Sand County Almanac in the 1940s, right? You know, half a century ago, more than half a century ago, that sense of the land ethic, as he calls it, and expanding one's sense of community beyond family and beyond a human social network, crucial as those are, to these other realms.
You know, I don't know if bird watching is a little bit different around the world. I imagine it's a subculture that has a lot of similarities no matter where you're from, but I wonder if Americans aren't just making it into a more competitive sport. Like, instead of shooting them, we're trampling through jungles, or we're trampling the underbrush to get at these exotic birds and capture a glimpse of them. What do you think?
Well, absolutely. I've seen that. I've seen competitive birders in action, and they scare me, so I stay away from them. And, you know, there's the 24 hours of birding, or the World Series of birding and so forth, and these contests, and they actually, I think, are quite valuable. But there is a percentage of people who do this recreationally who take it, I think, a little too far. But I would say that, you know, in other countries, especially in, you know, places, you know, less developed countries, in the third world, and tropical the countries in Asia, in South America, Central America, Africa, there is not the kind of birding culture that we have. Disturbingly, a lot of indigenous cultures that have had respectful and sustainable sorts of relations with the non-human community that they've been a part of, we're disrupting that through all sorts of things, electronic media especially, and so forth. And so we're at, a really interesting time where, and you see a lot of conservation groups, birding groups. The American Birding Conservancy, the American Bird Conservancy is doing great work in education outreach to developing countries, getting binoculars in the hands of kids and trying to sort of foster a sense of birding, not just as a matter of recreation, but as a matter of sustainable relationship with one's own future.
It reminds me of a woman came into our library. She's taken a lot of safaris in Africa, but safaris where it seems that she does really good work in the villages as she's there. And she bought up a lot of artwork by local school children, and they're being encouraged to draw the mountain gorillas to try to foster
right.
some kind of relationship with them as animals as opposed to just something in their environment that isn't really valued or noticed very much.
Well, absolutely, and I think we have to take care not to be condescending about that too.
Yeah.
You know, because we've done a lot of damage to our continent. You know,
yes.
we've done a lot of damage to our continent. And there are vast swaths of the American population that are understandably preoccupied with making ends meet. I mean, the economic crisis has really made it clear how close to the edge a lot of us live, and one sense of priorities gets reordered very quickly. And so for the long haul, I think we have to approach these questions with a sense of delicacy and respect. And I'm getting a sense that the environmental community in North America is far less interested in confrontational, you know, yelling and litigation, which got some things done, you know, in the 60s and 70s when we needed the Endangered Species Act, we needed the Clean Water Act, and so forth. But I think we're moving into a different sort of mode now in which conversation, reaching out, and finding common ground is really the way to go. And living now in the West for the past, you know, 7 years and seeing that play out on public lands debates has been interesting.
Yeah, and the West just seems like such a singular place for a lot of those kinds of conversations because of the history of the place and what is found there naturally. Another question was, what are the species that you think are going to be included in a similar book 50 years from now if we don't do something soon to change the species' fate?
Yeah, you know, that question has been haunting me for the past couple of days when I first read it. And I started to make a list, and then I thought, you know, that's going to be a long list. So I want to answer it in a couple different ways. This, again, comes back to my theme of this interview, which is, what is in your place that you care about? It could be a bird that seems relatively common, but maybe in 15 or 20 years it might not be. I don't know. So I think, rather than saying, you know, well, we may be writing a book about X, Y, and Z, I think the way to answer that question is to look at your own landscape and ask yourself, what is it you love and don't want to see go away, and work like hell to make sure that it doesn't go away. So that's part of the answer. And the little story I was going to tell a couple weeks ago was up in the mountains, about 3 hours south from here in the central Wasatch, and I was with some folks who were doing a survey for boreal toads. And boreal toads are tiny. They're very cute, actually, and they have a little racing stripe on them. We found tons of boreal toads at a strawberry reservoir. Now, if I had looked for boreal toads 50 years ago in the northern Wasatch where I live, I would have found them, but they're not here anymore. So that's a species that could be included in such a book. However, I want to pitch the focus, or I want to inflect the story with this sense of, here were a bunch of strangers who got together, working together to do these surveys, to help these creatures out, and maybe we'll be able to reintroduce them. Maybe we'll be able to find the cure for this fungus that's attacking boreal toads and other such creatures. So that rather than think of, you know, well, what will we lose and write about 50 years from now, why don't we think about what we have and we don't want to lose 50 years from now? That's a kind of here and now perspective. The long-term perspective, you know, I mentioned this earlier in the book, is just about everything goes extinct. You know, 99.9% of all the species that have ever been on this planet are gone. and they're not coming back. And there's no reason to think that we'll be an exception to that, or any other creature on the planet will necessarily be an exception to that, except, you know, maybe algae, right? You know, or, you know, some very simple
cockroaches.
Very hardy life forms.
Right.
And that is not an excuse to do nothing. That is not a reason for nihilism. I think quite the opposite. I think it frees us. I think it gives us a sense of moral agency that we create for ourselves, for the rest of the world. But I also find in the long view of things, and this is a view that it's been cultivated a little bit working on this book about meteorites, this cosmic scales, and things are very old, you know, the universe has been around for a long time. I find comfort in that kind of grand scale and process.
The last two questions from the Early Bird Book Club members are kind of related, but I sort of related it to, there were so many lines in this book that were so poetic and beautiful, but when you talk, it's as if we live in a house from which each hour we remove a foundation stone, a joist, a rafter. The house could fall to wreckage surrounded by weeds. I do not wish to grow old on a planet of weeds. And I found that just so evocative, and it reminds me two questions that people had. One was, have you had any experiences or seen any conservation efforts since publishing the book that have given you cause for greater hope? And then someone else said, what is the most obvious or simple measure we could be taking regarding conservation? In other words, do you think that a century from now the generation will wish we did?
I thought you were going to ask me about weeds.
You know,
yeah, I have experience with them.
I guess we all do.
You know, especially where I live now, there's so many weeds here. I have seen some significant changes in terms of, you know, overall public opinion. The biggest change I think has come in the past 3 to 5 years with climate change. I did not expect to see by this point public opinion turns so emphatically to this recognition that, yes, you know, climate change is real, human activity is driving this, and we have to do some things now. I mean, within a 10 to 25-year time span, the science is clear. There is no debate about, you know, the fact that we're forcing this. There's a pretension on the part of some to say there is such a debate, even somebody like Freeman Dyson, a very respected scientist. But, you know, even regardless, the things that we can do to slow climate change, we need to do anyway. So I look at that, and I don't know if this is answering the question directly, but I look at that as a huge paradigm shift in this country and around the world, and cautiously hopeful that we're getting it, you know, that we're getting it. And so then to relate it to one's own life, I think, I mean, I don't feel comfortable being soapboxy about telling people how to live. I mean, it's up to you, and I think you have to decide for yourself what matters and how you want to sort of carry yourself in a world that is increasingly fragile, and no one right way to do that. One of the things that I write about in the new book, it's much more memoir driven, and I write about my divorce, and I write about some big changes in my life. My mother passed away, and we, you know, within like 6 months, 3 or 4 major things had happened in my life, and that tempered me and sort of calmed the side of me that was maybe part of that self-righteous environmental, you know, pounding the fist on the table sort of approach to things. And so I look at that and I think one needs flexibility and one needs to calculate for oneself, you know, what is it that's most important? What are your values? How are you pursuing them? How do those correspond with what you want the world to look like?
And maybe, too, the book really reminds me that life is a lot about loss, and it's hard to face.
Mm-hmm.
But that just talking about that and being able to say there is something, we have no control over a lot of this kind of loss that happens to us. But
well, most of it, yeah.
Most of it. But getting back to how do we honor the memory of the beings that shared our life and are now gone, or how do we go forward and just taking those baby steps of just sticking to our life alone and figuring out how to make it better for ourselves with whatever we can control seems to be the only answer. And I like that you don't come to any major conclusions except we just have to decide those things for ourselves.
Well, I would think we do, and that's not to avoid the tough choices, but I think those choices have to be made individually after careful consideration. And that kind of care and that kind of consideration then can place one's life in a community context that is more helpful than you should do this, you should do that, you should do this other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, maybe it comes back to telling stories, to being, you know, in a place in your life, personally, in familially, socially, that you can tell a story instead of, you know, launch into an editorial.
Yes. Well, isn't that what the Bible is? You know, when you think about it, it's a longstanding tradition.
Yeah, yeah. I finished a recently a beautiful novel by Ursula Le Guin called The Telling. In it, the protagonist is on a planet where, you know, she's trying to figure out sort of the mores and the customs of these people, and it's beautifully written, as everything that she does is beautifully written. And the sort of foundation of that culture is the telling, and every story gets caught up in this, and it's just this, like, cultural version of, you know, Whitman's poems, and they just get brought in. Every story gets brought into this larger tapestry, and I think that is a way to approach one's life that I think it makes sense to me, at least.
Mm. Chris, I just want to thank you for sharing your time with the Early Bird Book Club. I think your writing is some of the most beautiful blend of the poetic and the scientific that I've ever read, and I know the book club members share that feeling, too. So we really, really appreciate it, and I really hope that we can have you back at the publication of your next book.
Well, it's very sweet. Thank you. This has been a delight, and I was delighted that the book was chosen and that the questions were wonderful, and I've had a good time talking with you, and, yeah, hope we can do it again.